We're going deep on commercial contracts today, those agreements that businesses rely on. You know, the kind where, well, sometimes those promises, especially those warranties, don't quite work out the way they should under the Uniform Commercial Code.
Yeah, and then the question becomes, what happens when things go really wrong? Like, what recourse does a buyer actually have?
And that's exactly where a case like Lincoln Composites versus Firetrace USA can really shed some light. This one's particularly interesting, especially for anyone, you know, deep in the world of commercial law. It's a real-life example of how courts look at the UCC when a seller doesn't really deliver on those promises.
Absolutely, a great case to dig into.
So our goal today is to break this case down, really get at those key legal principles, and pull out the practical lessons it offers. You know, cut through the legalese and make these concepts something you can actually use. So let's set the scene. Lincoln Composites, they make natural gas storage tanks, and obviously safety is a huge deal in that field.
Absolutely paramount.
Right. They bought this custom fire suppression tubing from Firetrace. Sounds like a pretty basic business deal at first glance, right?
Yeah, pretty straightforward on the surface.
But here's where things get interesting. This wasn't just some off-the-shelf part. This was a critical safety component in a really sensitive piece of equipment. And wouldn't you know it, this tubing starts to fail, and not just once.
Right. It wasn't a one-off. It was a recurring issue.
Yeah, repeatedly. It became brittle, started leaking gas. Now you've got a serious safety hazard on your hands.
A major problem.
Now, to be fair to Firetrace, they did try to deal with these problems, right? It's not like they just ignored the whole thing.
They did make an effort, yes.
So they were engaged. How long did this go on? They tried to repair these defects.
Yeah, for quite a while. Over 18 months, actually. They made multiple attempts to fix the issues.
Wow, a year and a half of trying to get this right. But despite all those efforts, the core issue wouldn't go away.
Unfortunately, the problem persisted. The tubing just kept degrading and leaking. It was a fundamental issue.
So after all that time, after a year and a half of these ongoing failures, Lincoln decides, okay, we need a different solution here. They want a refund, which seems pretty reasonable at this point. What did Firetrace say to that?
Well, Firetrace dug in their heels. They pointed to their repair or replace warranty and said, basically, look, our agreement limits what we have to do. We can fix the faulty parts, we can replace them, and that's what we've been trying to do.
That was their stance.
But Lincoln argued back, hold on. This limited remedy you're talking about, it's failed its essential purpose. It's not working. And that's what led them to file a lawsuit.
Things escalated.
They did.
So what happened in court initially? Was it a pretty big deal?
It was a significant outcome. The jury actually sided with Lincoln and awarded them almost $1 million in damages. That's not insignificant.
No, not at all.
Naturally, Firetrace wasn't happy with that outcome. They decided to appeal, taking it to the next level. And that move just shows how high the stakes were in this case. It wasn't just a minor contract dispute.
Right. It had real implications. Okay, so let's get to the heart of the matter here. What were the legal questions the court had to grapple with on appeal? What were the big issues they were looking at?
There were two primary legal questions at the center of the appeal. The first one was whether Firetrace's repair or replace remedy, the one they were relying on, actually failed in its essential purpose. And we're talking about essential purpose as defined under the UCC. If the court found that it did fail, then Lincoln would have more options, broader remedies they could pursue. The second big question was, whose contract terms actually controlled the deal between Lincoln and Firetrace? And these two questions, we'll see, they're really interconnected.
Okay, I'm following you. So let's unpack that first question, failure of essential purpose. That sounds like a pretty key concept in the UCC. Can you explain what that means in this case specifically?
Absolutely. It all comes down to a specific section of the UCC, Section 2719. It deals with limitations on remedies in contracts. In this case, the court used a three-part test, a specific analysis, to determine if Firetrace's repair or replace remedy had really failed in its fundamental goal, in its essential purpose.
Okay, a three-part test. Let's break that down. What were the three parts?
All right, the first part was all about whether the buyer, in this case Lincoln, had given the seller, Firetrace, enough of a chance, a reasonable opportunity to fix the problems. And here you have this extended period of 18 months where Firetrace kept trying to make repairs. That strongly suggested that Lincoln had given them a fair shot, a reasonable opportunity. It wasn't like they rejected the product right away after a minor issue.
18 months is a long time. That's a lot of chances to fix it. So what was the second part of the test?
The second part focused on the product itself, the fire suppression tubing. The question was, even after all those repair attempts, was it still defective? And the evidence showed pretty clearly that it was. The tubing was still becoming brittle, it was still leaking gas, which meant it was failing in its most basic function as a safety component.
So despite the efforts, the problem was still there. And what about that third and final part of the test? What did that focus on?
That last part looked at whether the buyer, Lincoln, was basically denied the benefit of the contract because of these ongoing failures. Think about it from their point of view. They bought this tubing to make sure their natural gas tanks were safe and could be sold. If a key safety component like the fire suppression system is unreliable, the whole tank is compromised. You can't sell it. It's dangerous. The court agreed with the jury that Lincoln didn't get what they bargained for in the contract.
It makes sense. They were deprived of the core value they expected from the deal. So with all three parts of this test met, what did the court decide about this failure of essential purpose idea?
They were very clear in their conclusion. 18 months of trying to repair a critical safety component, and it's still failing. That meets the legal standard for failure of essential purpose under the UCC. We're not talking about minor inconveniences here. This was a fundamental breakdown of the contract's purpose.
It wasn't working. So what happens legally when a limited remedy like this fails its essential purpose? What are the consequences for the buyer?
That's a great question, and it's really important. When a limited remedy fails like this, it's basically like it never existed. It's unenforceable. Mm-hmm. The buyer then gets to pursue all sorts of remedies that are available under the UCC, a wider range of options. One of those is the right to claim what are called consequential damages. These are indirect losses that come from the breach of the contract.
Mm-hmm.
In Lincoln's case, this meant they could try to get back the money they lost because they had to scrap those defective modules.
That seems fair. The limited remedy didn't work, so they needed other ways to recover their losses. You also mentioned something about the court really emphasizing the safety aspects of this case.
Yes, that was a big part of their reasoning. They made it clear that even a small chance of failure, even a low risk of something going wrong with a safety critical component like this fire suppression tubing, could make the whole product essentially useless. Imagine a natural gas leak. The potential consequences are so severe that even a slight possibility significantly devalues the tubing. Lincoln couldn't use it. They couldn't sell tanks with it. And that definitely played a big role in how the jury decided the case.
Makes sense. Okay, so we've talked about the failure of essential purpose. Now let's get into this other issue, the battle of the forms. That sounds like a real clash of contracts.
It really was. Here's the situation. Lincoln's purchase orders, the documents they used to buy the tubing, specifically stated that their own terms and conditions, the ones posted on their company website, would govern the deal. And those website terms were very important because they didn't limit remedies at all. There was no repair or replace clause like the one Firetrace was trying to enforce.
So Lincoln's standard terms gave them more flexibility if something went wrong.
Exactly. Firetrace, on the other hand, had their own warranty, a limited repair or replace warranty, and they claimed that should control the whole transaction. So the court had to figure out whose terms actually made up the contract. Was it Lincoln's, which allowed for more remedies, or Firetrace's, which restricted them?
And what was Firetrace's main argument? Did they say they never agreed to Lincoln's website terms?
That was their claim. They argued that they never specifically said, yes, we agreed to those terms and conditions on your website. So they believed their own limited warranty should win out. But the jury looked at all the evidence, especially the fact that Lincoln's purchase orders clearly pointed to their website terms.
Yeah.
And based on that, they concluded that Lincoln's terms were part of the contract, even without a separate signature or anything from Firetrace.
So the way the deal was structured was enough for the jury to say those terms applied. So for a listener, especially those studying law, what's the big lesson here about this battle of the forms? What should they take away from this case?
The biggest takeaway is that clarity is key. You have to be crystal clear about whose terms and conditions are going to govern a business deal. Lincoln did this well. They put a reference to their website terms right on their purchase orders. It wasn't hidden. This case really shows how important it is to be meticulous, very careful when you're drafting these transactional documents. Make sure your terms are included and that it's impossible to misinterpret them. Don't leave it to chance or assumptions.
Don't leave any room for doubt about whose rules apply. You mentioned something about Firetrace challenging the instructions given to the jury. What was that about?
Essentially, they argued that the trial court didn't instruct the jury properly. They claimed those instructions were either wrong legally or not detailed enough to help the jury make the right decision.
So they had a problem with how the jury was supposed to decide the case. What part of the instructions did they focus on?
Their main issue seemed to be with how the jury was supposed to figure out what reasonable time meant in terms of Fire Trace's repair attempts.
Yeah.
The trial court told the jury it was up to them, based on the evidence, to determine what a reasonable time frame would be in this situation. And that's a question of fact, something for the jury to decide.
And Fire Trace disagreed with that.
They argued on appeal that those instructions were either incomplete or didn't properly state the law. But there was a big procedural problem with their argument, something that really hurt their case.
Oh, what was that?
The Eighth Circuit, the appeals court, pointed out that Fire Trace didn't object to those specific instructions during the trial itself. That's a basic rule in court. If you have a problem with how the jury is being instructed, you have to speak up at the trial. You have to give the judge a chance to fix it right then and there.
So because they didn't say anything at trial, they couldn't bring it up on appeal. They lost their chance.
Exactly. The appeals court said, because they didn't object during the trial, they waived their right to appeal that point. It's a big lesson for anyone involved in litigation. If you don't raise objections at the trial, you can't use them later on appeal. It's too late. Now, the appeals court also made a point of saying that even if Fire Trace had objected properly, they didn't think the instructions were wrong anyway. The court felt the instructions were consistent with the UCC, so the appeal probably wouldn't have worked even without that procedural issue.
So it was a double whammy for Fire Trace on that point. Let's move on to the damages. They weren't happy about that almost $1 million award. What was their argument against it?
Well, Fire Trace argued that the jury's decision to award over $920,000 was way too high. They said it wasn't supported by the evidence that was presented during the trial. They basically asked the appeals court to get rid of the damages entirely, or at least reduce them significantly.
And what can appeals courts actually do in a situation like that? Can they just replace the jury's decision with their own number?
Not quite. Appeals courts are very careful when they review damages awarded by a jury. They give a lot of deference, a lot of weight to the jury's findings on matters of fact. And the amount of damages is considered a matter of fact.
So it's not just about whether the appeals court judges would have come up with the same number.
Exactly. The Eighth Circuit laid out the very specific circumstances where they could overturn a damage award. It has to be clearly against the great weight of the evidence. That means no reasonable jury could have reached that number based on what they heard at trial. Or the award has to be so ridiculously high, so grossly excessive, that it shocks the conscience of the court. Basically, it has to be completely out of line with the harm that was suffered.
So there's a high bar to clear to change a jury's decision on damages. What did Lincoln do to justify such a large amount? What evidence did they use?
Lincoln presented a strong case that those faulty fire suppression tubes made their Titan modules worthless because of the ongoing safety risks. They had to scrap a bunch of modules because the unreliable tubing made them too dangerous to sell. The damages they were claiming were directly tied to those financial losses. They could show the real impact of this problem.
And what did the Eighth Circuit ultimately decide about those damages?
The appeals court didn't find any reason to change the jury's decision. They said there was enough evidence to support the amount the jury chose. Basically, Fire Trace couldn't meet that very high standard required to overturn a jury's factual finding on damages. So the award stood.
Okay, we've covered a lot. Let's wrap up with the key takeaways from Lincoln Composites versus Fire Trace. What do you think is most important for our listeners, especially those who are on the path to becoming lawyers?
Three big lessons come to mind. First, those limitations on remedies that you often see in contracts, like a repair or replace clause, they're not ironclad. They're not a guaranteed way for sellers to avoid responsibility. If the seller can't actually fix the problems within a reasonable time, that limited remedy is considered to have failed its essential purpose under the UCC. That's Section 2-719. When that happens, the buyer is free to pursue any of the remedies available under the UCC, including consequential damages, to cover their losses.
So those limited remedies are conditional. They depend on the seller actually being able to fix things.
Absolutely. The second lesson is about the battle of the forms, which can get really complicated. When you have parties exchanging documents with different terms, it's crucial to be very clear, very explicit about incorporating your own terms and conditions into those documents. Lincoln did this right by referencing their website terms right on their purchase orders. That was key to their success in this case. Don't leave anything to chance. Make those governing terms clear and unambiguous from the very beginning.
No room for interpretation. Spell it out.
Right. And lastly, this is especially important for litigation. Remember that appeals courts give a lot of weight to what the jury decides on matters of fact. That includes things like whether a repair period was reasonable and how much the damages should be. If there's evidence to back up those findings, it's very hard to get an appeals court to overturn them. It also highlights how important it is to make any objections you have known during the trial itself. That way you preserve those issues for a potential appeal.
If you don't speak up then, it might be too late. Really insightful points. So for all you future lawyers out there, think about those warranty clauses. They seem pretty standard, but what happens when a seller can't actually live up to them? Could a limited remedy turn into no remedy at all? And how can you advise your clients to avoid these kinds of problems, both in how they write contracts and in what they do if a contract is broken? Lots to think about. Thanks for this deep dive. It's been a fascinating case to explore.
Glad to be here.
And until next time, keep on learning.